Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen. I'm joined today by Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell and our Corridor news readers Chloe Weinstein, Simone Otley, and Jaya Francis. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie with her guest, local artist Marnie McDiarmid, who joined Christina to discuss the 25th anniversary of the Real Out Queer Film Festival in Kingston.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. The Real Out Queer Film Festival is celebrating their 25th anniversary, with their festival kicking off today and going until February 10th. Real Out started back in 1999 as a working group project with the Ontario Public Interest Research Group, with the goal of increasing the visibility of the 2SLGBTQ+ community and supporting queer, independent media artists across Canada and abroad. The festival has become the second largest queer film festival in Ontario and the longest-running film festival in Kingston. After going through over 400 submissions this year, Real Out will be showcasing over 85 films from 35 different countries between February 1st and 10th, 2024. To chat a bit about the beginnings of the festival and how far the festival has come in the last 25 years, I sat down with the founder, community activist, and artist, Marnie McDiarmid. To get us started, I was wondering if you'd like to maybe introduce yourself and talk a bit about your involvement with Real Out from the start.
My name is Marnie McDiarmid, and I was one of the founders of Real Out, which I guess is kind of a shocking 25 years ago. And at that time, there really wasn't very much positive representation of queer lives, like in cinema or even in mainstream media. Like, it's kind of astounding to me to think about how different things were when we started the festival compared to how they are now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you saw the importance of an event like this back then. I was wondering if you could speak to that and the importance of an event like this both back then and 25 years later.
Sure. Well, you know, when we started the festival 25 years ago, I'll give you an example of how different things were. So I see, you know, at that time we were starting a festival for a bunch of reasons. Like, one was because there were very few like queer positive spaces where people could gather and form community. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons was to get people together. And even though things have really changed quite a lot, there, you know, Kingston doesn't even have like a queer bar or anything, you know. Like, I think people still identify that there's a lack of queer, like really kind of queer owned queer positive spaces in the community, and so the festival serves that need for people. And it also brings together a really diverse like cross-section of people because of the way that the festival is programmed. And this has always been true of Real Out. Like, we always took a kind of anti-oppressive approach to programming and did a lot to really highlight the intersectionality of people's identities and make sure that different people were reflected and different kinds of queer experiences were reflected in the programs that we did. So bringing together like diverse cross-sections of the community, and that can be in lots of different ways, like even in terms of age, right? Like bringing people of diverse ages together, which happens like astoundingly rarely in general, I think, in society. And then the other reason that, or function, I guess, of the festival when it started is, and I think still is true, is it was really a piece of political advocacy. You know, when we started the festival, we, and this is a story that I was referring to at the beginning of this question, we would go to the different media organizations to want to ask them to promote what we were doing. So this would be like your mainstream radio, for example. And at that time, they wanted to, there was a lot of discussion with the stations about, like, why is this important? Why is this something that's actually relevant that should be promoted on, like, mainstream media for everybody to hear? And one of the things that people wanted to do was they didn't want to use the word gay or queer. They wanted to talk about it as an alternative lifestyle festival. So that, just that shows you like the kind of context that we were operating in that time, that it felt like very political to walk downtown and put up posters that listed all of the films and, you know, were so clearly like kind of celebratory and out and proud, like all of those things were super important. I think you see that as important now too, right? Like, you're a huge backlash against the way that our society has shifted in terms of understanding gender. And you've seen that locally in terms of how drag queens at, like, the Brockville Library were getting hate mail.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you for speaking to that. And that's really shocking to hear that, especially it was only 1999 that you guys were getting this off the ground. I was wondering if you could also speak a bit to what that first year was like, just getting things off the ground and how you remember that experience.
The festival started like many things do. It started out of like a love relationship. So I was involved with a woman in Toronto who was on the programming committee of Inside Out, which is a queer film festival in Toronto. And so through knowing her, I was like, this is a great thing. Like, we should do this in Kingston. And so a colleague of mine, Stephen Maynard, I talked to him about it, and he was totally on board. And the two of us, with Roberta's help, decided to bring some films to Kingston. So she, you know, being on the programming committee, she had a really good eye for what was out there and helped create a one-night, like, collection of short films. And we had it in a gay bar. That was called Club 477 at 477 Princess Street. And the place was completely packed. Like, it was just overwhelming, the kind of response that we got for those films, and to collectively watch those stories and hear people laughing together, sighing together, commiserating together. It really showed us that we had to keep doing it. And so after that first year, we got a whole bunch more volunteers and started a small collective of people that decided to try to do this annually.
Yeah, that sounds like such an amazing experience for your first year. Do you have any favorite moments from your time with the festival?
It's kind of telling that some of my favorite moments are moments that were, oh, not my favorite, the ones that stand out were ones that were really stressful. Yeah. Like, it was a really low-budget, low-tech event. Like, so, for example, we were screening a film about Black drag queens and at the screening room. And at that point, the screening room, we had to bring our own sound for some of the films because of the formats that they weren't on, you know, big reels. So we had to bring a lot of equipment. I'm not a super tech person, so this part always stressed me out. And of course, something went wrong with the sound system. And so we came out the doors of the cinema after testing it and trying all kinds of things. And we didn't know what to do. We were standing on Princess Street talking about this problem. And this kid was nearby who was on a skateboard, kind of mucking around, and I guess overheard our conversation. And was like, well, I have an amp that I think would help. And skated off home and then skated back with their amp and came into the cinema and helped us set it up. And then it was ready to go in time of the show. So that was a good moment. Another really kind of crazy moment was when we showed the film based on the Sarah Waters book, Tipping the Velvet, and that was a screening on campus in a huge auditorium, and it seated a lot of people, like 400, I think, at least people, and it was packed. People were dressed up. It was opening night, super excited, and the film hadn't arrived.
Oh my
because
God.
It was being sent from the States, and this was a huge stress when we were organizing back in the day, because there would often be only like two copies of a film that existed like in the world, and they would have to be shipped across the border, and we always had trouble with like customs and things at the border, and so we had a broker that would try to get it, facilitate that. And so there it is, a Friday night, the cinema is, the auditorium is filled with people super excited to watch this film, and it wasn't there. And then, like, moments before the thing was supposed to start, there somebody had been driving it from the border, and it got there in time, and I think we started, like, half an hour late or something. But, we've also had just some amazing filmmakers come. We had a great party with filmmaker Jerry Rogers, who did a screening called My Left Breast about breast cancer, and from Newfoundland, and she was a gem. We've had Richard Fung come from Toronto, like just these really memorable times of, because Kingston's small and because the festival is small, that it has a real kind of community, like intimate feel to it. Yeah. And it means that people get to actually meet the people who made these films and talk to them over a drink after seeing the movie. And so that's I think, one of the things that's really different about this festival than festivals in bigger cities is that it's so accessible.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like you've had all your own little movie moments at this movie festival, which is so fun. As a founding member, I was wondering what it's been like to watch Reel Out progress over the last few years.
Oh, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was involved with the festival for the first 8 years. And then after about 8 years, I was like, okay, I think, you know, it's like I want to go and do some other things. And I think the sign of a really great project is when it has longevity, right? Mm-hmm. When it matters enough to people in the community that there's a host of people carrying it forward. And so even though I was, you know, really involved in getting it to happen, after those early days, it's always been a crew of people who have made this festival happen. And I think before you've organized an event like this, it's hard to have any idea of how much work it is. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that's been wonderful to see, is how many people really care about it, how much it still matters to people, and they show that they care by putting their labor into making it happen and doing it with, like, you know, like a spirit of kind of kindness and generosity and joyfulness. And I think seeing people work together in that way, you know, led sort of at the helm by Matt, who's just done a fantastic job, then that's an amazing thing. And to see the festival really stay true to its kind of grassroots political values, you know, that also, it's really resisted, I think, some of the forces that have made maybe some queer events more homogeneous. And that's an amazing thing too.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure you're excited to be an attendee this year at the 25th anniversary. Is there anything in particular you're really looking forward to this year in the next, I guess, the next 10 days of celebration we have coming up?
Yeah, I'm really excited for the family program. I have a kid, and I know a lot of queer youth, and I think that having programs like that for younger people to go and see is, you know, fabulous. And then I personally love the shorts. So if there's a shorts program, I'm going to be there, because you just, you know, you can't see that stuff any other way, really. it's very hard to access a lot of those films. And it's also really interesting to see them grouped together. So the curatorial process that goes into making those shorts programs is also really interesting to me. So there's one on Monday that's, I think, films, I think that they're films from the African continent, so all different countries across the continent. And then there's another shorts program that's about hopefulness. And anyway, there's a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. So those are exciting to me.
Once again, that was Marnie McDermott, founder of Real Out Queer Film Festival, on the festival's 25th year. The full schedule of films and events, tickets and passes, and all things Real Out this year can be found at realout25.eventive.org.
We now head over to Chloe Weinstein with a story from the local journalism initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about the findings from the Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington community consultation on the decriminalization of personal drug use.
Thank you, Jesse. Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington Public Health have released the findings from a community consultation on the decriminalization of personal drug use. The city surveyed members of the community to gauge the willingness for Kingston to apply for a Section 56(1) exemption to the Canadian Drug and Substance Act, CDSA, from the Health Minister. This would mean that possession of small amounts of drugs for personal use would no longer carry a criminal charge. The survey found cautious optimism towards decriminalization, with common agreement that the current punishment approach is ineffective. Committee Chair Susan Stewart said the biggest takeaway from the consultation was that the community is ready for change when it comes to drug policy, but that concerns remain. While the consultation found that the community believes decriminalization shows potential to improve the safety of and reduce stigma around substance use, there is also concerns that it could worsen the drug poisoning crisis and lead to increased drug use. Stewart said that the survey showed that some in the community are still confusing decriminalization with legalization, and that there are no consensus whether the same decriminalization policy should be applied to youth. Candace Christmas, project engagement manager with Support Not Stigma, said that despite some remaining concerns, there is enough proof that shows that the punishment approach to substance use is not working. She said that regardless of system capacity, decriminalization is just a first step that can get people who use substances, especially young people, off a repetitive, damaging cycle. Overall, 63% of survey respondents support decriminalization efforts, and 70% agreed some change to drug policy is needed. Justine McIsaac, who runs the Consumption Treatment Center at the Integrated Care Hub, noted that while it was encouraging that people have started to understand the issue and call for policy changes, it is unfortunate that it took the crisis worsening to get to that point. As McIsaac put it, the need for intervention was in 2012. McIsaac also noted that there has been a 5% increase in deaths every year since the crisis began. McIsaac said that decriminalization could be an encouraging step that would help people, but its effectiveness would be limited without federal decriminalization and safe supply. McIsaac noted that without federal decriminalization, the onus would be on the city to make sure everyone, substance users included, have access to safe, comfortable shelter. Moving forward, KFLNA Public Health identified next steps as in-depth consultations with key sectors, assessing the capacity of health and social services, and learning from other regions, namely British Columbia, who decriminalized substances 1 year ago. While the survey points towards potentially huge changes to the local drug policy, the process is very much in its infancy, with KFLNA Public Health still yet to consult with Health Canada. Thank you to Owen Fullerton of YGK News for that story. And now, over to Dinah Jansen with a story from Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstel, about a potential change in branding for Holy Cross Catholic Secondary School.
Thank you, Chloe. Kingston's Holy Cross Catholic Secondary School is considering a nickname change. Students and staff have gone by the Crusaders moniker since the school first opened in 1986. A video produced by Holy Cross Grade 12 communication students for the school's 25th anniversary in 2011 features past staff and students who explain that the name was chosen by the student body. Former Vice Principal Glenn Williamson says in the video that Crusaders was chosen to encapsulate the ideas of the institution, working together to achieve a common goal. Faith, and determination. In that 2011 video, former teacher Sister Peggy Malcolm noted that some staff in the religion department objected to the name originally due to its historical context. Yet Crusaders won the student contest and took on a life of its own with chants, cheers, and more recently a mascot. Dori Forestell's article spells out that the term crusader is tied strongly to the Crusades, a two-century war waged by Roman Catholics against the Muslim populations of Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Palestine. Thus, the word crusade also carries the connotation of violence and even xenophobia, contradicting the sense of openness and inclusivity it once sought to convey. Principal Terry Daniels noted that the name has been part of an ongoing discussion at the school and within the broader Algonquin and Lakeshore Catholic District School Board. With the implementation of a new equity plan, the board made a potential name change an action item for the two schools in the district with the Crusader nickname, the other being Nicholson Catholic College in Belleville. Daniels noted that over the last several years, the school's teams have begun putting Holy Cross on their team uniforms instead of Crusaders because students and staff have voiced concern about the nickname. There has been some pushback against the name change by some Holy Cross alumni, but Daniels acknowledged that growth and change are inevitable over time. For example, Regiopolis Notre Dame is the oldest Catholic high school in Canada, and its current nickname, Regi Panthers, is just the latest of many name updates since that school's inception over 175 years ago. More recently, École Sir John A. Macdonald Public School was completely renamed and became École Maple Elementary School for similar reasons. The next step will be to ask students and staff, and then the community, to work on a new name. Then a smaller committee of students and staff will narrow down the choices and scrutinize them. Thank you to Michelle Dori Forestell of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up in our next segment is Jaya Francis with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the accidental issuing of duplicate interim tax bills in the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Dinah. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands is making the public aware that some property owners have received duplicate interim tax bills. The township has now issued a statement to the public regarding this issue. In the statement, the township explained that the duplicate bills were sent due to an error during processing and distribution. The statement noted that property owners are only responsible for paying the interim tax bill amount once, and that no further payment is required. The township apologized for the error and declared that their team is working diligently to resolve the issue and prevent any future occurrence. For people who have any questions or concerns, contact the township at 613-659-2415 or the deputy treasurer at extension 216.
Thank you, Jaya, and thank you to Keith Dempsey of the Brockville Recorder and Times for that story. We now send it over to Simone Otley with a story from Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Morrisburg Leader, Philip Blanchet, about approved attendance figures for the St. Lawrence Parks Commission's Alight at Night attraction.
The popular Alight at Night festival at Upper Canada Village saw its fortunes brighten at the end of 2023, with 5,000 more people visiting the site. This year marked the 23rd year for the event, which is run by the St. Lawrence Parks Commission. A Light at Night saw nearly 41,000 attendees to the festival, said Jeff Wasick, director of SLPC Historic Sites. That accounted for a 13% increase in attendance from 2022. This season's visitor count was still down from the near record-setting attendance of 46,000 set in 2021. Wasick said a highlight of the season was welcoming the event's 750,000th guest in early December 2023. The season saw several new interactive activities added to the over 1 million lights adorning the 1860s historic village. These included a giant Alight Bright, a new snow tower toss game, and the opening of Blitzen's Barn, a reading zone with scheduled story times with one of St. Nick's elves. This year also marked the return of the village's miniature train ride. According to the SLPC, the economic impact of A Light at Night was estimated to be over $4 million, according to the Tourism Regional Economic Impact Model. This calculates the direct and indirect benefits to the regional economy. The park is closed now until the start of the summer season in May.
Thank you, Simone, and thank you to Philip Blanchet from the Morrisburg Leader for that story. We now move to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJAI Amherst Island, Ted Evans, with an update on the future of the Amherst Islander 2 ferry.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township's delegation at the Roma Conference regarding the Amherst Island Ferry was a success. The township will see Helm Management Services join on as the project manager going forward for the Amherst Island Ferry. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend talks about the delegation.
The delegation was definitely a success from our point of view. We definitely got the minister's support for appointing Helm Management Services as the project manager for commissioning the Amherst Islander 2. And as well, we got the minister's support for our ongoing attempts to petition Transport Canada to defer the dry dock maintenance for the Frontenac 2.
With support from the minister, Townend notes the township is able to move forward.
The minister was very engaged in the delegation, which was really nice to see and definitely inspired confidence. We really feel that we do have the support all the way to the top to do what we need to do.
With members of the public wondering about timelines and progress, Townend notes the support from the minister is a great step forward.
It's really good. It's really serious progress. You don't often get the opportunity to say that, or if you do say it, people maybe question the sincerity or the genuineness of it, but no, it is genuinely a really good step forward.
Townend describes just what Helm will be doing for the project.
Helm will be able to, basically put together a charter for what the rest of the scope of the project looks like in terms of what needs to be done, the timelines associated with that, a communications plan around that so that the public are able to be kept up to date with respect to the various benchmarks to getting the boat into service. And also that the public are able to, we haven't got it confirmed from Transport Canada, but the key piece is to have Helm helping us and having MTO's buy-in to petition for an extension of the Frontenac 2. But that in and of itself should give the public some confidence that there'll be some breathing room and that we'll be able to maintain fairly uninterrupted service and sustainable service to the island, during the commissioning process of the Amherst Islander 2. So that's a real breath of or sigh of relief as well.
For CJAI and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans from CJAI FM for that story. We now head over to Brenda Little and Craig Foster, the Local Journalism Initiative team at CJPE County FM in Picton, with a report on the Prince Edward County Curlathon.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, 6 times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
It took a team of people to organize this curlathon event, with a few people staying the entire 24 hours, making sure everything ran smoothly. County businesses donated food for the participants, as well as items for the silent auction, but many organizations and individuals have been raising money since the Back the Bill campaign began in 2018, and so far, $21 million has been raised. The curlathon was very successful and truly a fun event. I spoke with organizers Pam Piercy and Ron Stiggs.
Be very happy with the event and exhausted.
Well, most of all, we're very happy with the event. We exceeded our goal by quite a bit. We had hoped to raise 35,000 in pledges. We're at almost 49,000, which for a second year running is fantastic. Some of us are more exhausted than others, but I think it just shows the true commitment of Prince Edward County Curling Club to the construction of our new hospital. And it shows the spirit of our community writ large.
Absolutely. And you had more participants this year than last year?
Yeah, we were up. Last year we had about 112. This year we sat somewhere around 163 or 164. And part of it was timing. We heard feedback last year that the March break wasn't great. So we decided to move it back into January. We did it when we first started our calendar, and that way we had the date available, and it worked fabulously.
Well, congratulations to you both. I think you did an amazing job.
Thank you so much.
For County FM and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little and Craig Foster of CJPE County FM for that story. Up next, we have CFWN Local Journalism Initiative reporter Jeff Gard's recent story about Port Hope flying the Pan-African flag for Black History Month.
The municipality of Port Hope will hold a special flag-raising ceremony in celebration of Black History Month on Thursday at 11 a.m. Mayor Olena Hankivsky, along with members of council and staff and the community, will be on hand as the Pan-African flag will be raised at Town Hall. The mayor will share brief remarks, and she spoke about the occasion during a conversation with CFWN, Northumberland 89.7.
I'm quite certain that we're going to have strong community representation at this historic event. I think this, along with some of the other initiatives you've seen this council spearhead, is really our commitment to equity, diversity, and inclusion. But I want to say in particular for this event, the initiative came from the community, and we responded to that community request by Angela Brogan. And we look forward to those closer ties with our community to respond and reflect the growing diversity of the Port Hope community and to really recognize the diversity that we have, to celebrate it and to grow awareness and to encourage education for people to become more and more aware when we're celebrating Black History Month, when we're celebrating a month around Indigenous history and contributions, that people really do understand that there's more to it than just a flag raising.
The Pan-African flag will fly at Town Hall throughout the month of February. Reporting for Northumberland 89.7 FM, I'm Jeff Gard.
Thank you to Jeff Gard of CFWN in Coburg for that report. Over to Jesse Bell with the CFRC Environment Canada Weather Report.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. On Thursday, February 8th, we saw a high of 4 degrees Celsius with a mix of sun and cloud overnight, dropping to a low of 1 degree. On Friday, February 9th, we have a 60% chance of precipitation, but thankfully it will be rain, not snow, as we will see a daily high of 6 degrees Celsius. Overnight, temperatures drop by 3 degrees to 3 degrees. Moving into the weekend, on Saturday, February 10th, it'll be 4 degrees with a 30% chance of precipitation, but we will drop below zero overnight with a low of negative 3. Sunday, February 11th, a mix of snow and rain as temperatures will hover around the 1 degree Celsius mark with an overnight low of negative 6. Moving towards the start of next week, Monday, February 12th, it will be a mix of sun and cloud and a high of negative 1 with an overnight low of negative 7. And Tuesday, February 13th, it will be cloudy with a high of negative 2 degrees Celsius. This concludes your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. This is Jesse Bell signing off and throwing it over to the talented team at CFRC for your community events and concerts calendar.
And now it's time for the CFRC Community Concert and Events Calendar. On February 8th, the Art, History, and Fine Arts DSCs will be presenting the 2024 Arts Gala at Union Gallery from 6 to 10 p.m. Tickets are $15 and only available to students in art, history, or fine arts. For more information and to purchase tickets, head to theassessstore.com. February 9th and 10th is the 5th Annual Queen's Conference on Indigenous Reconciliation, focusing on reconciliation in business and law. To see the locations of the events and a detailed itinerary, purchase tickets at eventbrite.com. The Queen's University Department of Art History and Art Conservation's Graduate Visual Culture Association will be hosting the 23rd Annual Context and Meaning Graduate Student Conference from February 9th to February 10th. This year's conference seeks to facilitate discussions regarding how time is experienced and constructed, how we view the past through a contemporary lens, and how artworks, images, and other objects of visual culture mediate history. The conference will take place at Agnes Etherington Arts Center on February 9th and over Zoom on February 10th. To register for free, visit www.gvca.ca. On February 10th, head over to the rehearsal hall at the Tet Center for Creativity and Learning for their one-day Pottery Odds, Ends, and Imperfections sale. The sale takes place from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Also on the 10th is the 15th Annual Valentine's Slow Dance taking place at the Grad Club from 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Formal dress is encouraged, but not necessary. Tickets are $25 and can be purchased at eventbrite.com. This event is 19+. Part of Union Gallery's annual fundraiser, Side by Side, is its live ticketed event taking place on Zoom February 10th at 7 p.m. All ticket holders claim an artwork, but the order in which they select is left up to chance. All funds raised directly support Union Gallery's not-for-profit mission and programming. Purchase tickets at www.zeffy.com. And lastly, on February 11th, head to YGK Combative from 1 to 2 p.m. for Women's Intro to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a form of submission grappling that incorporates aspects of Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, Judo, and wrestling. To register for free, visit ygkcombativesgroup.com. And moving into our concerts for the week, on February 5th, there are no concerts scheduled. On February 6th, Tom Savage will be hosting an afternoon happy hour jam at the RCHA Club. This is an open mic jam with Tom Savage and friends where everyone is welcome. The event is free and runs from 4 to 7 p.m. On February 7th, head over to the Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar at 8 p.m. to see Frank Ryan perform. This event is Pay What You Want by donation to the musicians. You must be 19+ to attend. On February 8th, Spencer Evans and the Goat Steppers will be performing at the RCHA Club from 7 to 10 p.m. for free. Also on the 8th, head to the Royal Tavern for free karaoke at 8 p.m. You must be 19+ to attend. Moving on to February 9th, Excuses Excuses will be performing with support from Melancholy Caravan and the Petras at the Mansion. The show starts at 8 p.m. and you must be 19+ to attend. Tickets are $15 and can be purchased at themansion.rocks. Craig Cardiff, a singer-songwriter known throughout Canada, will be performing at Musiki Cafe on February 9th at 6 p.m. Tickets are $28.25 and can be purchased at Eventbrite. Doors open at 5 p.m. On February 10th, Brother Elsie and guests will be performing at the Broom Factory from 7:30 to 10 p.m. This is an all-ages event. Tickets are $20 and can be purchased at ticketscene.ca. Also on the 10th, Doug Vanderhorden will be performing at the Embassy Live Music Cafe from 7 to 9:30 p.m. Cover is $10 and doors open at 7. This is an all-ages event. Over at the Mansion, indie band Rexford Drive will be performing with support from the Backsteps and Skeleton Park Radio on February 10th from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. Tickets are just $10 and may be purchased at linktree.com/Rexford Drive. You must be 19+ to attend. And lastly, on February 11th, head over to the Toucan at 11:30 p.m. for a free 19+ karaoke event. This has been Danielle with your event and concerts calendar.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and New Leaf Link. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter at CFRC. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for tuning into The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Did you know that New Leaf Link offers day programming for adults with developmental disabilities? We serve families in Kingston and South Frontenac. Our program focuses on arts, healthy living, and community connections, including summer camp. New Leaf Link's caring staff and talented instructors provide a place for everyone to learn together and build friendships. If you or someone you know would like to join our program, please visit newleaflink.ca for more details. Together, we can grow, connect, and belong. Your true friend loves you just as you are.